This is the last day of class. These papers are a reflection of the assignment in which I invited you to discuss where you think you are and how it feels to be there and all that. One of the difficulties that I thought it would be important to examine with you is there are certain conceptual problems that we need clarity. So I'll just go through some points here. So let's start with this paper. Internally, there's a tremendous amount of the information I've received in this class that I have only a vague understanding of. But I feel confident that if I maintain my tenacity of purpose, it will be revealed to me. It's rather saying the notion. I'm comforted in the knowledge that if my sentiment is correctly aligned in accord with what I know of my nature today, that I can still go well, although lacking a complete intellectual understanding of the material. I began this transformation business with the foolish notion that the difficulty to it was in knowing the material, not in knowing myself. I thought that would talk about it. But the doing is the really difficult part. Doing with no other motive than to do. I've always done my work in that fashion. But my spiritual conduct has until now been a succession of accidents. That's a very curious sentence. Let me see whether you can tell us that. I've always done my work in that fashion, but my spiritual conduct has until now been a succession of accidents.
Why should the two be separated? That the work is has no relation to the spiritual conduct?
Precisely. So I suggest that you have a long thought about the rather crucial error in that sentence. If one had always done other work than what is called spiritual conduct in that fashion, then spirituality will take care of itself. Okay? Have any problems with that? If you get it out there, before you have to sit down and be hanging with the blue books. How are we doing? No problem with that? Right. I began this transformation business with a foolish notion that the difficulty to it was in knowing the material, not in knowing myself. But the doing is the really difficult part, doing with no other motive than to do. I've always done my work in that fashion, but my spiritual conduct has until now been a succession of accidents.
Well,
if
work is always done in order
to do it, then it would be an accident. Correct. I believe my fate and fortune are now coming into correct relationship. Now the last sentence. In the Enchiridion, chapter 27, how is it that the nature of evil does not exist? How many of you had that question ready? Two. Perhaps you read it like this, the nature of evil does not exist. You have read it, the nature of evil does not exist. What does not exist is evil's nature. Why? No.
Really? No.
It's not an entity that we were talking about before. It's just complementary to it. Good. The balance. One wasn't trying to overtake the other. You know, like the battle. It's a balance. The evil, you know, and the good. Like, a decaying good is well, a good in decay would be an imbalance in the good, which would bring more of the evil. Right.
The decay is not the principle. Health is the principle. Right. Health is good. Principle, then, is not the same as condition. The good is the principle. Evil is a condition manifesting the privation of principle in operation. Evil is a privation in the operation of principle. Okay. Any problems with that? We'll go on to another one now. Here's another paper. Problem. Colon. I want to turn the study of principles into an academic ology. There are, of course, several viable interpretations. Myths are, you know, multifaceted, blah, blah. And so naturally, I had to ask, but how can I figure out what to obey? The answer, you can't until your ego has shrunk. What's the matter with that answer? You can't until your ego has shrunk.
The only time to start is right now. It's putting off until the future what should be done right away.
Yes, that's a psychologically astute observation, but what's the matter with the statement in principle?
You must obey to have your ego free.
Well, that's correlative, I think, in point with what your colleague just said. But that's also the case, yes.
No, there should be a won't substitute for the can't. For that person.
Won't. So now let's get away from the psychology of it into the principle of it.
I was going to say, in terms of Castaneda, the ego on the island of the Tonal is something that cannot be gotten away from. We want to strengthen, not to shrink.
That's correct. What is it that needs to shrink, if not the ego? What's my identification that needs to shrink? My idea of it, with respect to my comfort, is not the same as it. So I don't have to give up my ego. If I did, I should lose one of my principal powers. That's silly. What I need to do is not be confused about my relationship. Not to give myself airs that I am what I'm not. Neither should I depreciate myself as being less than I am. Another way to put it is, do not become self-conscious about self-transformation. Don't become self-conscious about self-transformation. Just do what requires to be done that is at hand. With a pure act of attention. Taking full responsibility for your actions.
transformation will take care of itself.
By self-conscious there, you mean not to undertake self-transformation with more of an introspection than that, as if I was thinking of self-conscious in relation to self-possession. Seems like that would be the only way to undertake.
When we're self-conscious about self-transformation, we're filled with internal chatter. We're always talking about how it will be when we do better. And we never begin. Or how it was when we did better. Which has no relation to now either, does it? See, what we're really frightened of is doing what is at hand with a pure act of attention for fear that we'll disappear. We don't trust our fundamental intuition that we exist. I cannot really believe that I'm here. Can't leave it alone. I'm frightened that I might volatilize. Now, see the relationship between this other paper that I'm going to read now and what you just said. In this class, you've stressed the seriousness, even gravity, of each day. I have found that in my seriousness, I'm inclined to despair because I continually fall short of my expectations. What relationship do you see between that and what we've just been talking about?
And telling yourself what you should be doing.
That's right.
He should get off his back and simply do what is infinitely harder, which is what? Get on with what it is now. You see, there's a total freedom in that. And he is shutting himself up in a little cage. It seems in this long, difficult process, one must not take himself too seriously, or he will find himself chained from growth by despair. Does seriousness and the sense of humor work together for our growth, our double-mindedness? Well, see, the error there is to oppose seriousness to a sense of humor. If one is truly serious, one is single-minded. If something's funny at the time, and you make a pure act of attention to what's there, what are you going to do? They'll laugh, aren't you? Certainly. If it's outrageous, you're going to be outraged. We'll be angry. That's the way you should be. There's not a question of this kind of division, is
it? Does it go with Zen and archery, where you shouldn't be elated with your good shot, just as you shouldn't be depressed about a bad shot?
That's right.
If I feel it's where do consequences fit into it?
Perhaps you'd elaborate on that so I do understand precisely what you're driving at.
Some of the duality of thought, or some of the things that have been expressed in this paper and the last paper, can arise conceivably from a person who talked of expectations. Some expectations can arise, or the fear or the joy of expectations, not that they shouldn't be necessary, arise from consequences of interaction with other people who also have their own self to deal with.
One should not be attached to projected consequences. One must take into account consequences in planning. But if in planning the consequences, though at the time of planning, seem reasonable expectations, I send myself ahead and pin my expectation at the level of well-being upon those consequences that I foresee. I would have done a very bad thing at that time, because the chances are the consequences will not turn out exactly as I have planned, or maybe not at all. Then where am I? I'm going to be equally lost then as I would be if I planned incorrectly. So it isn't a question of my intellectual skill in planning. It's a question rather of my emotional condition while I plan.
Were, however, there something to happen to you at the podium which instantaneously I might find extremely funny, such as dropping lecture notes, something that you might regard as embarrassing in your own context, and were I to realize this humor, this mirth and laugh, it might be out of place in terms of consequences.
It wouldn't be out of place in terms of consequences. If I were so wanting in humor myself, not to be able to laugh with you, it would be out of place at the time for you to entertain a guffaw. Not because it isn't funny, but because I would have drawn sufficient attention to my deformity at the time in being unable to laugh with you, that for you to guffaw would make you appear ridiculous, because it would be disproportionate to the event, wouldn't it? That's what's meant in the Confucian tradition by propriety, what is appropriate. One must always be concerned for whatever is at hand with a feeling for proportion. As, for instance, just such a sense of proportion a certain duchess showed when she invited to dinner a young and rather gauche young woman. At dinner, the young woman's earring fell off into the soup, at which point the duchess removed her own and dropped it into the soup. Now that was appropriate. It would not have been appropriate to have made her guest feel conspicuous. At which instant, when the Duchess dropped her earring into her soup, all the other ladies present naturally dropped theirs. And that's correct. That fineness of sensibility is, of course, rather rare, particularly in our time, should you say. In fact, exquisite sensibility is not cultivated in our culture. We are rather raw. That's a British understatement. The difficulty with propriety is that there's no time to exercise it. That's what they, because if your state, if your condition is not such that it can meet the occasion adequately at the time of the event, it's too late, isn't it? See what's so hopeless about that? The Duchess didn't have time to take a lesson in what was appropriate when the poor little thing lost her earring. Which is simply another example that, in spite of ourselves, we always do at the time what we are. So we can't do anything else at the time of what we are. Inevitably, we show our hand. At the time, any time. And nothing is so obvious as an attempt at any time to hide what one is at that time. Now, next paragraph. And I want you to tell me what you think is the matter with this. The thrust of this class seems to me, remember thyself. It would do me, and I believe others, a lot of good to discuss methods, tools, for this remembering. For example, keeping a journal, doing a mantra, and systematically making and breaking habits of our words, thoughts, and actions. Yes, you're on the right track. You might put it somewhat more to the point. Did you have your hand up before?
There is no method to self-transcendence.
No, that's correct. Self-transformation does not have a method.
Nor does propriety, we're saying.
No. It would do me, and I believe others, a lot of good to discuss methods, tools, for this remembering. Self-remembering is a way of being, but it is not a how-to. So let's make a distinction between way and how. That might help. If, for instance, I should be undertaking a how-to, a technique, that's what we mean, isn't it, by technique, a how-to. And my attitude in undertaking was incorrect with respect to self-transformation. How could the technique benefit? Is that clear? It's not clear. Self-transformation is not a goal that lies outside the activity taken to reach it. Therefore, no method can come between oneself and the goal. I can't be over here with a method that I'm employing so as to get to self-transformation. Is that clear? At least semantically clear. Right. Because self-transformation occurs precisely in relation to how I go about anything. Self-transformation is at issue in my performance as such. I do not perform in order to self-transform. Self-transformation is or is not occurring. By self-transformation, I mean self-awakening and the practice of self-rule. They are not occurring in any other context than my present performance as such, regardless of what I'm doing. You see, the difficulty with so much of spiritual instruction is that it operates under the delusion that you have to do all these things, these good things like meditation, yoga exercises, for how long? So that a portion of my day is given over to spiritual exercises, and the rest of the day is given over to things that have nothing to do with my spiritual exercises. And I'm hoping that I have funded enough power from the performance of my spiritual exercises to carry me over through this mundane and secular effort that I have to put in. And that when I run out of my spiritual power, that I will repair to my corner in the room where I fund spirituality. Now, that's pretty much the thrust of most spiritual counsel, so-called, isn't it? Well, it is all bunk. Utter. Then what are we talking about? Nothing that I do at the time, regardless of what it is, that means that self-transformation is on the line equally when the Duchess is washing her teeth in the morning, as it is when she is giving her bank in the evening. If I am double-minded in the performance of anything, I wash myself up. You see, the delusion is that somehow I'm the same if I don't self-transform. But I'm not. I'm continually changing. Whether I like it or not. I'm not. Existence is activity. So I am, whether I like it or not, continually undergoing change. So my problem is not to change. My problem is to change well. And I am changing well only in respect of the quality of my act. At any time, in any place, all the time, in all places. There is no hiatus admissible. There is no vocation, there's no vacation from that vocation. That's the reason why people complain that the thought makes them tired. You see, their intuition is correct, namely, that they cannot have time off. And it's the terror of doing anything without time off that causes them to look no further into the matter at the time. But why would you want time off from going well? Isn't it wrong that you'd want time off from going ill? See how stupid it all is? So they're already going ill, and they're thinking that they would like to change and go well. And then you come along and you say, well, everything that you are doing is concerned in self-transformation. You must never be inattentive to what is at hand. And it never occurs to you. It could be the case that precisely as they are functioning in that spirit, namely, making a pure act of attention to what is at hand, that the energy for keeping it up is ever presently available. Not enough to carry you over to the next step, just enough for now. And as long as you are sincerely making yourself available for energy to carry you over to the next step, and that seriousness is evidenced by the purity of your attention at the moment, then that energy will be supplied. That's what is meant theologically by grace. That the energy that one cannot generate himself is supplied. But why it is the case that grace is overflowing, superabounding, it's not charistic. Grace is not promiscuous. Grace is not sentimental. It's available only on condition that I truly desire it. And if I'm in a double-minded state, I cannot desire it. Therefore, it's not available. And that's why I feel tired. So I need it. Oh, I'm so tired. I'm so tired at all. Did you hear that a lot? From yourself? Of course. Oh. There's no need for that at all. I don't mean that there's no need for physical fatigue. I don't mean that. But I'm talking about this thing in here. You know, this is the place where you really get tired. Oh. There's absolutely no need for that whatsoever. Ever. Ever. So there's no method between me and going well.
What is the function when a person is involved in activity which is going against the propriety of the time or going against consequences, which causes the same person to feel tired in their heart? What is the function? Is the person, because they're doing something that they feel is either wasteful or wrong, because they're required to do it, is it they're not asking for the grace to proceed? They're not asking for the energy to proceed, or are they actually getting
tired? If you feel tired, under those conditions, in the sense of tired I'm talking about, I'm not talking about genuine psychological fatigue or physical fatigue. I'm talking about spiritual fatigue, which is simply a species of despair. It's because I'm attached to what it is that I feel I am losing, or what I haven't the strength to acquire. That's all. And I have no business being attached to either. I have no business being attached to anything. That doesn't mean to say that I have no business loving. It means I have no business loving in a self-serving way. That's what it means. I have no business loving in an opportunistic way. I have no business loving so that loving becomes an instrument of my getting something that I don't think I have now. I think it fair to say that the overwhelming pathology in religion is this notion of technique. You see, even those who run around saying that all I need to do to be saved is to believe. Good works don't mean anything. All I have to do is believe. Well, their gimmick is believing, isn't it? But